Accession number 29953, Reel 1.
Mr. Edie, Reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born, please?
Cooper Angers, 21st of February 1917.
And where were you brought up?
In Cooper Angers. I went to school in Perth Academy and then started work with Customs and Excise in Glasgow.
And what did your father do?
He was in the post office, sorting clerk, telegraphist and so on. So that was where, and he also, which was a good thing, he became interested in the radio receiving as broadcasting stations, and he'd be one of the first person who built a set that could receive these things in Scotland. And I can always remember he had to get a sawmill to cut about a 50 or 60 foot pole to stick in the garden and take a wire from it to the house and everything, and you're working with these valves that glowed with the rheostat, so if you turned them up a bit they glowed a bit more and you could get more power out of them and all this sort of thing. So I had that as a background and built my own crystal set by the time I was about 10 or something like that, and it went on from there.
One last question about your father. Yeah. Had he been in the First World War?
Yes. He went out to Mesopotamia, as it was then. Had a nice spell in India. He brought back a whole lot of photographs, because where they were, they could print and develop the things and all the rest of it, which are quite useful.
And he came back in one...
Oh, yes, yes, he was all right. He was with the Royal Engineers on Signal's side, which meant that they were further back in the line.
Had his interest in signals, was that what sparked it, or had he already...
No, I think it was just a general interest in it. Well, of course, as a telegraphist and the post office, you got that as a beginning, and of course one or two persons had this, and in those days you didn't buy a set, you bought a kit set. You got all the bits and pieces and put them all together. And if it didn't work, you could send that whole thing to a centre who would check it and find out what was wrong and send it back to you. And of course it was all handmade. I mean, the sets were about this size of wood and Bakelite front and all this sort of thing. And of course I built my first crystal set because of that, when you're working with this wee catch whisker.
So you were at school in Cooper Angus?
School in Cooper Angus and then Perth Academy. And then I joined the Customs and Excise. And was there until called up beginning of 1940.
Where were you when war broke out?
In Glasgow. Yeah.
What do you remember of that? Did you, for example, hear the broadcast on the Sunday?
Yes, I would probably hear the broadcast. I don't remember too much about it. We knew it would be coming. Actually, no, that's not right. What happened was that we had arranged holiday. Brother, myself, father and mother, to go to Scarborough, and a cousin came along with us, and we were actually in Scarborough when the announcement was made, and of course we had to get back then from Scarborough any way you could get back home. We didn't get the full fortnight holiday but that was the beginning of the war. That was where we heard the announcement from Churchill's, from Chamberlain.
But as you were saying, it was expected.
We didn't know when we went on holiday that anything really serious would happen. We didn't, at least we hoped it wouldn't, so we didn't really pay much attention to it. But of course, when it did happen, it was a scramble to get back home any way you could. From England, which was not Scotland, very far away.
And so how did you come to join the army?
Well, I was called up the usual time. We were asked not to volunteer specially unless we had a very good reason for it, because of how difficulty in coping with the people who were called up because they were reservists and everything else. But you just took your turn and you're called up in turn, and I had opted on the application for Royal Signals, and I went to Catterick. Which I was very lucky there, because there's about 30 of you in the squad, and when we got down to training on signals procedure, we had an ex-post office sergeant doing the training, and he didn't like to have any messing around very much. He wanted to teach people Morse and that sort of thing. And they tested us all. I was the only one that knew enough Morse and so on. And he said, you know, I can put you right through and you'll be in the final lot before they go out, because we can't teach you anything in that way. But he said, I don't have an assistant. You'll not get any promotion, you'll not get any extra money, but you seem to be very friendly with everybody else. So if you want, you can stay with me and unofficially help me with anybody who isn't as good as they might be to bring them on. So that's why I agreed to do that, and it kept me with the people I'd met before there and everything. And it was very nice. And then, of course,
That was still at Catterick.
That was at Catterick. And then, of course, Dunkirk, the fall of France took place. And we always kept looking at the orders and that sort of thing. And there were 10 names put on the order, including mine, as 10 men to be reported the next day. And we were sent by train to Salisbury. Never told what it was for, just the 10 of us down there. We got down there and we're all tested for signals, and the other 9 weren't anything like up to scratch, but I was. So I was immediately put on one of these listening stations to try and pick up any group of British troops who were still in north of France, so that they could be have a vessel of some sort sent over to pick them up. So I had that until it became such that there was none left there.
Did you make contact? Did anything?
Well, we were on a 24-hour watch now, beyond 8 hours. There's none of anything from my point of view that I had been made contact. Most of the contacts had been made earlier. We were just at the tail end of it all, you see. But we kept working in case anybody could make contact with us. But it just one of those things. And of course, as soon as they decided there was no more need for that, the 10 men were sent to Chester. Why, where, for anything else, no idea. We got to Chester, and of course the others had immediately to get further training. I was fully trained, and after a short time I was sent to Birmingham. There were these stations in main cities which kept in touch with, well, from our point of view, Western Command with Chester. It was 24-hour working period. You were calling each other up so that if there was a bad air raid or anything upsetting any of the communications, then we would be able to take over. And the station was in the middle of Birmingham. Not very far from one of the railway stations, and I can remember that it was a big bit of waste ground, and we were on a what would have been just a very not very safe shelter underground, just no more. And that we were there for the time, and then there had been air. We had air raids. Coventry got the worst one. And then I was suddenly recalled to Chester, and the 10 men were sent to it's in the book in the paper there, Droitwich Spa, and they had a hutted camp had been built on the outskirts of Droitwich, which was to be the rear headquarters of the War Office when the Germans invaded the south of England. And a whole lot of huts had been built there, and there was two were for the radio communications, and next to them were the teleprinters. So we had to set up our station there. There were actually two, one either end of the whole lot, which would allow us to work this break-in business where you're transmitting from the one station and receiving at this one here, and vice versa. And it was very up-to-date. It had a special mission set, Type 3, 100 times better than any of the Army ones. and HRO receivers, which was about one of the best American receivers at that time. We had the Creed automatic transmitter and all this stuff all in there. The others with me had no idea about any of it, but fortunately, I did know, with having been interested in radio things. I joined the RSGB when I was in Glasgow just before the war, and it was great from my side. And we set all this up ourselves. It was a very nice time, especially as the whole lot of the big hotels had been taken over by ATS for recruits coming in. And between that and the spa set up, it was really quite pleasant. But we got it all set up, and one of the signals officers from Chester came down and said, we want you to make contact. You'll not know where the station is. You don't know anything about it. You have to make contact. This is a time, call signs and so on. I went over this. I said, well, at least could you tell us in which direction the station is? Is it north, south or east, west? Because the aerials were dipoles and they were slightly directional. So he finally agreed it would be east, west. Didn't say which, of course. And we were just given the call sign and frequencies. He said, of course, this is all a waste of time because you'll never make contact. Nobody in our area makes contact unless they get on the telephone first and tell the other one to send and that sort of thing. But I knew that was a waste of time saying that. So we were in contact with this other station, which we didn't know where it was or anything else. Fortunately, they were really good. They had been commercial operators on it. And they turned out to be the British troops in Northern Ireland. So that we made contact with them. It was to be, I think, 48 hours constant contact. We kept passing the messages backwards and forwards because the other lot were really good at in Belfast. And we spent half an hour sending dummy messages backwards and forwards, and then the other station said to wait, and then they came on in plain language, suggest we make contact every hour on the hour and pass two messages each way, which we did. And the person in charge at Chester came down after the whole thing over, and he came in and he said, I know how you'll be feeling. You'll be really sorry for yourself that you never managed to get in contact, but don't worry about it, it'll be all right. And he said, well, we've been in contact all the time since the very beginning. Oh, really? Yes. He didn't say any more, he just left. And that was it. So we were called back then, and which was fine, except that there are others with me, the other ones, were fitted into the normal setup, but I wasn't. I was sent on what was a special course. It turned out to be one of these drill and duty courses at Harrogate it was. Nothing but drill, PT, everything you can think of, and everybody else in the group with me had all done something that was not really right, you know. Yeah, utterly fantastic to do this. And we have that finished, and I went back. And
do you know why you ended up on that? Was it just a matter of routine? That was the next course to.
No, it wasn't a course at all. It's punishment.
Yes.
Square bashing. Square bashing, PT, everything you could get. Peeling parsnips to the nth at night. It would have been miserable, only we were all in the same boat, but they always picked on one or two persons to get really nasty with them. And I got my turn about halfway through. I was really, really angry, really annoyed about the whole thing. And there was a notice came on the board asking for volunteers of persons who had either commercial or amateur radio experience. Well, of course, this was a standing joke there. They would put everything through like that, and you'd finish up doing some extra piece rubbish and everything like that. But I put my name down, and of course, nobody had done it. Somebody said to me, oh, some silly fools don't go and volunteer to go and see this. I said, well, I have. We're sorry for you. But it was this Captain Kay who was there, and he was very nice. And he asked what commercial experience you had, amateur or commercial. And he asked a few technical questions, which were easily answered, and everything else. And he thanked me politely and said, I can't guarantee it, but you may hear from me in the next 2 or 3 weeks. So I went back to Chester after it, feeling a bit annoyed at everything that happened to me. And then after about a fortnight to 3 weeks, I was summoned before the chief instructor sort of thing, captain, and he started saying how well I had been doing, how wonderful things I had done in Birmingham, and this high marks at this other part and all the rest of it. This went on and on and on. I thought there was something really fishy here. But then he finished and thanked me for doing. And if you really behave yourself and do very well, you might get the chance of being promoted to Lance Corporal. And I was done to go out, and he said, oh, by the way, there's a silly thing came in saying that you had volunteered to do something or other, but we'll just tear it up because, you know, we're looking after you. I said, I want to go. We argued for about 10 minutes. I want to go. And that was all I would say. And eventually he just to say, well, get out from me. And then I was summoned before the company commander. What's all this nonsense about you not wanting to stay with us? We'll say you're right. These other things are all rubbish. We don't want them. I want to go. So they finally gave in, and I got a ticket to report to the War Office in London as a private, kit bag, rate coat. And, you know, I knew my way about London because I had the holiday there, so I got there, but I didn't go right to the War Office. I got to near it and could watch and see what was happening. Of course, there's all these red tab people striding in and out, and a sentry there with his fixed bayonet and all the rest of it. I thought, oh, Lord, what's going to happen here? But when there was a wee quiet spell, I set off. Nobody stopped me. I went right in. There's this wonderful semicircle of a table, and the staff inside were all in their ordinary uniform types thing. As soon as they came forward, can we help you? And said, I said, I've got to report to room 98 at the War Office. Right, it's on the first floor, and direction to get to it. And if you leave all your kit here and everything, well, you'll have to wear a badge because we don't allow anybody to come in. But the main thing to do is to remember to hand it back or we'll lose the things. So I went up, and there was this civilian, a very attractive young lady, and as soon as I got on, she started chatting away about things, not bothering what I was there for at all. Went on for quite a while. Then she got some papers out of a filing cabinet and still held them, chatting away. And then another chap came, knocked on the door, and he came in, and he was on the same thing as me, but he didn't care about chatting anybody up. He just wanted to get what he'd come for and go. So we got out and got a taxi, and we finished up at the we got on the train at Paddington. Neither of us had ever heard of the railway station we were going to. And so we finished up at the training set up from there.
And where was that? Where did you?
That was oh goodness, it's gone at the minute. I mentioned it earlier. That was where we went first. Grendon Underwood. Yes, we never heard of Grendon Underwood before. So I was got there and. Great apologies, they had no accommodation to speak of, so they had cleared all the horses and cleaned the place out, and we went to live in the stables, the two of us. Well, the agents under training, they had to get some decent accommodation, and some of the others were not much better than us, and so I was there for the spell, and it was the first time. Of course, we didn't know what we were doing to start with, you see, this was all explained, and the day after we got there, Captain Kay interviewed us, my companion, Ken Howell, I think it was, went in first, and he came out and just went straight away, and I was taken in, and I'd met Kay before, so he talked away, and then he said, you'll be on the final training of agents before they go into the field, into the enemy-occupied territory. On the sets that they'll be using, and that was it. And I was on that all the time.
So you, after that, were you given an introduction to how the sets worked and given training?
Well, we were just given the sets, and I said I want the circuit diagrams of the sets, each of the things, because I knew if anything went wrong. To me, you had to show them what you could do if there a repair, a minor repair, or anything like that was required. So, I mean, as far as I was concerned, I wanted a circuit diagram of the sets each time. I would know what I could tell them if they had any problem or anything like that. If the agents asked any questions, some of them were technically good. Other ones didn't know anything about it. But it was just from my side, it was great because with having the amateur experience and you listen to the commercial stations, in any case, just for fun and that side of it. That it was. It suited me very well, so I was in the final training from early on. Other ones who had been there before me were doing other things.
Did you instruct the agents? Was it a one-on-one?
Yes, it was one and two where I was, simply because of the numbers. It meant that what they were doing was they had the set that they'd be using when they went into the field, and they were working to another instructor who was probably about 200 or 300 yards away, but I mean it was there, they got the training on that, and when one was actually trying to make contact as they should do and everything else, the other one would ask any questions and I would tell them anything I could to help. So we were always working with a twosome in that way. But it was again fairly easy to make contact because we had nothing very far away at that time. But once they got the hang of it, they were quite all right there. But then, after a short time, the place was too small. There was one actual episode which really upset quite a lot. I mean, we knew the agents. We had our own small mess, but in the evening, one of the bigger rooms was a free-for-all for agents under training, cooks, anybody could go there. And I went there regularly just to have a chat with any of them there. And I knew that three, I think they were Danes, either Danes or Norwegians, they went off for their parachute training, and only two came back. One had done a zoom right down. So they came back and they were pretty upset. They were finished all their training and everything else. So I said to the other instructors, I was going along to this general meeting room to see if it was happening. And just before I went in, I thought it was a funny thing, it was just a bzz, bzz, bzz noise. And I got inside and all the country section people, each one in a group, were all standing and they were whispering to each other. Absolutely fantastic. You went in there and there's about five, six groups of people all whispering to you within the group. And nobody made any move before. As soon as you went in, somebody was saying, oh, come and join us, sort of thing. Nobody made any move with me, so I walked away to the far side of the room where there was nobody much standing there. And then just then another person came in and he got inside the door and he stood like shocked. And he was actually, I was training him, his code name was Judoni. He was a nice chap and everything else. He stood there and looked around and he saw me and he made straight across from me. He said, this is no good. We've got to do something about this. This is no good at all. I said, if you like, I'll go to one group and you go to another group and we'll try and get them to speak in their ordinary language. No, that wouldn't be no use at all. I know what to do. He said, before I came into this, I played second lead in Ivor Novello's Dancing Years in London. I'll go and do my spiel there. I said, look, there's no gramophone, there's no piano. It doesn't matter, I can do it all. I'll sing and dance for them. And he did. He went in the middle of the room, clapped his hands, everything stopped talking, you see, whispering. And he just started off and he went through the songs from Ivor Novello's Dancing Years. It was wonderful. When he finished, and he was wearing boots and a battle dress, everybody gave him a great clap and the whole thing changed. Everybody started speaking their own voice and everything else. It was just marvellous. Yeah.
So different nationalities were all,
yes,
all in the same place,
yes,
being struck together, presumably under,
well,
kept away from each other, perhaps.
Not necessarily, just depend, it just depends. I was only on a more or less 1 to 2, you see, so I didn't know what was happening much on the other side of it, where they were just learning Morse for the first time. I didn't know, I was never involved in that.
Do you remember any others, any other particular agents?
Oh, there was another one. Oh, I can't remember his good name now, but he was young, a young French bod, and he was just fun. He really was. He would carry on quite a lot and that sort of thing. And the funny thing with him was, I got on well with him. This Giudani who was with me, he was quite a hoot too, because the two persons there, and he was on the set, and he'd finished the set. I'd had to help him to get in contact this time, you see. So when he finished, he got up, moved his chair back, looked underneath the table, looked all around about, and said, "What are you looking for?" He said, "You've got a switch somewhere there that you touch with your foot, and that's why you can get it and I can't." It was all this sort of stuff. It was really quite funny. But this other chap, his name was Pamblong. That was a code name, White Bread. It was that sort of thing. Instead of giving himself a French name, he would do something that was just different. And the funny thing with him was, years afterwards, when I was at headquarters signal office with the invasion started and everything else, I was in the pub at the end of Baker Street having lunch, and this crowd, obviously French, came in and they formed one of these things, holding on the person in front to weave themselves through the tables to try and get a table which was empty. And just as he was passing me, he just winked. So he had remembered me from then. I don't know what happened to him, because they were putting some of these back in to try and find out the missile launching sites for the V2s. So whether he was there with some of the others and they would go in after that, I don't know. I never saw him again. But you know, it's just so funny. You get this one stood out a mile at the training station, and you see him in London years afterwards, just like that. It was quite interesting.
So how long were you at Grendon Underwood for?
Oh, just a matter of a month, 2 or 3 months. I would get there about September, and I'm sure it would be by January I was at Tame Park. But I was the only instructor going there. This huge setup, and there would be about 3 persons under training and myself, because the whole place was being sorted out for getting a complete move, but it gave us a chance of working a distance, at least 10 miles there. And I can still remember the one night in particular, because this chap who was training as an agent, he wasn't very tall, French, and the other room which he had apart from his bedroom was this huge room with a coal fire and with great big settees and everything in it, and I knew he was about somewhere, and I went in, and he was sitting on this couch like this in front of the fire because there was just nobody else there that you would speak to. But the rest all moved after that, coming in when the place had been sorted out, fanny drivers to take people out with their A set or B set into the country about 5 or 10 miles, and they'd work back from there, throw a bit of wire over a tree branch and set themselves up and do that.
At this stage, the fannies that were
yep.
working there, were they primarily in these sort of jobs?
They were drivers, drivers only at that time, in a way. But it's just one of these situations. It was very easily done, and of course it was a very big set up there as a house, much bigger than Grendon. That's why it went there. Then Grendon was changed to being the base station after that. But that was at Tame Park. It was really, really quite good. And the ladies who were driving were very good. There'd been one was Lady Brocklehurst, and she apparently, from what was said, was one of the first women to drive across the Sahara. Her face looked as if it had been across the Sahara. And the Honourable Hester Littleton, we had to test another set once, and 3 of us plus her set off from Tame in a van to drive as far as possible away from Tame and work back. And we finished up near the Lake District somewhere, and we did that and everything else. And on the way back, the driver looked after us well. She arranged to get the actual place was Nonceres Inn in Yorkshire. I can always remember that name. It still probably exists. And she got a billet in the house near there and arranged for us to get food at the pub and this sort of stuff. And we got within about 15 miles of back home when it was a strange bit, of road, and I was sitting beside her in the front. She didn't say anything, and the car just coasted and stopped. And I said, "What's happened?" She said, "Don't ask me. I don't know anything about cars. I don't know anything what goes on under the bonnet. No idea." So the other two and I got going. Battery was flat, no fan belt, but we had plenty of wire, so we joined up the batteries that we had, and we got home. Utterly ridiculous. Yeah. But it was a very good time. The Fanny drivers were really very good and very considerate and looked after everybody very well. Let's do that for them. But that was it. The other thing that...